When it comes to solving problems, it is best to start with the simple stuff. If you ever called tech support for anything that isn't working, you know, a printer that you're about to throw out a window or a computer that you're mad at, they always begin by asking you the same infuriating question. Is it plugged in? Is normally number one. Number two, have you tried restarting it? And you are sitting there on that call, and of course you say the right thing. Of course I've done that, as you hit restart or whatever, as you check the power cable to make sure it's plugged in. And then sometimes, the worst is when you're on the call and it works, and then you have to sheepishly be like, oh, well, yeah, I guess it resolved itself. I figured it out. Thank you, bye. And you just try to hang up as quickly as you can. They begin with those questions because the simple answer is normally the one that you need. You know, sometimes you're going to need something really complex and technical and all of those different things. But generally, when you start with the simple stuff and make sure that that is solved, you get to where you're trying to go much quicker. And so this passage about the lead up, the very final lead up to the crucifixion of Jesus, this at times feels like the simple stuff of Christianity. This is the true meat and potatoes of our faith. And yet, if we miss this, we miss everything. So this is the simple stuff, but this is the absolute bedrock of what we need to hang on to. If there's something that I hope you leave with today, it's that the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus is not just the door into Christianity, it is the whole of the Christian life. That's what we really want to see today. So Matthew 27, verse 1, it tells us this. It says that early in the morning, all the chief priests and the elders of the people made their plans how to have Jesus executed. So they bound him, they led him away, and they handed him over to Pilate, the governor. Now, 2 weeks ago, when we finished Matthew chapter 26, we saw the religious trial that Jesus had. This was Jesus in front of the Sanhedrin. This is when they're trying to find some way that he violated Jewish law, something that he did that would get him into religious trouble. And when Jesus claims deity in front of them, they say, sweet, we have our perfect case. He's blasphemed. Let's get him out of here. Now, they still don't have the power to execute, which is what they really want to do. Only the Romans at that time had that power. Fortunately for them, they have a pretty crazy guy in power. Historically, Pilate was known for brutality. You know, so the idea of we're going to ask Pilate to execute somebody, you know, this is asking him to do one of his preferred things to do, to show his strength and flex his muscles and show his power over the people that he led. So the idea that we're going to go to Pilate and ask him for an execution, he may just, kind of, like, it's a rounding error to him. You know, he was so brutal that he's willing to kind of just throw more people into the mix. So that's the heart of their plan. Verse 4, we see this little side picture, or verse 3, I should say. It says, when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. I have sinned, he said, for I have betrayed innocent blood. Well, what is that to us? They replied. That's your responsibility. So we're going to see this little moment in Judas's life. We see, notice it says he's not surprised by what happened, but he's seized with remorse. Going into the accepting of that bribe to betray Jesus, this is exactly what he knew they would do. This is exactly how he knew things would play out. It's sort of before we do something wrong, we see our gain, and after we do something wrong, we see the hurt that it causes. You know, before you say the dumb thing in your marital argument, you see how it's going to win you the argument. And then afterwards, you see how it hurt your spouse, or, you know, put that into 1,000 different situations. Beforehand, we see what we have to gain. Afterwards, we see what we've lost. And so Judas is filled with remorse, and he's hoping that with these elders and leaders, he's going to be able to have something, maybe just to ease his conscience, perhaps. You know, maybe they're going to say, don't worry, we were all in this together or something like that. Instead, they just say, what is that to us? You made your choice. Your choice is now sealed. There's a moment like that that will come for all of us. As we live in the age of God's grace, we also need to hang on to the truth that there will come a day when all decisions are sealed, where all decisions are final, and where repentance won't be something we can chase after anymore. It's like what Hebrews 12:18 says about Esau, where it says, afterwards, after he had given up his inheritance and blessing, as you know, when he wanted to inherit this blessing, he was rejected. Even though he sought the blessing with tears, he could not change what he had done. We do reach a point where all decisions are final and sealed, and it leads Judas to what we see next. In verse 5, so Judas threw the money into the temple and left. He went away and hanged himself. And the chief priest picked up the coins and said, it is against the law to put this into the treasury since it's blood money. So they decided to use the money to buy the potter's field as a burial place for foreigners. That is why it has been called the field of blood to this day. Then what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. They took the 30 pieces of silver, the price set on him by the people of Israel, and they used them to buy the potter's field as the Lord commanded me. Now, Judas, I know, super encouraging stuff from the start. Judas throwing the money into the temple in part might be his way of trying to accuse the priests a little bit. Of like, hey, I'm not even taking this. This isn't mine anymore. You gave this to me. It's almost like when a kid gets in trouble and mentions every friend that helped them ever to, you know, get them to it. He's like, you guys did this too. You know, he's kind of doing one of those to throw it in front of them. There's this weird moment where the chief priests had no issue paying blood money, but had a problem receiving it back. It's like one of these things seems worse than the other, guys. Like, if you're in this mess already, like, your hands are not clean. You know, they're just trying to distance themselves from what Judas had done. And so Judas is left with this choice. What will I do to make this right? And he decides the only thing that's right is for me to pay the price myself, is for me to be the one who sacrifices in my own place. What is so fascinating about that to me is that Judas was around every time Jesus predicted his own death. Judas was around in Matthew 16 when Jesus said that he would be handed over to the chief priests, that he would suffer many things at their hands, but that he would on the third day rise again. Judas had heard all the same teaching that Peter and all of the other apostles had heard about how Jesus would suffer in our place and rise again. Judas should have known forgiveness was possible, but because of shame, because of embarrassment, because of remorse, he decides, I can't bring this back to my Lord. I have to deal with this myself. I have to be the one that pays for this. And I bring this up because often, even as believers, we face sin like Judas does. We think that we're the ones that should have to pay. We're the ones that should reap the consequences. We're the ones that should have to deal with the wrong we've done. The heart of the gospel is that Jesus deals with it for you, that Jesus makes the path for you. You know, when we say something hurtful, we'll say things like, I'll make it up to you. That's a nice thing to do to show that you're invested in the relationship, but that's not the heart of Christianity. The heart of Christianity is that when something hurtful gets done towards us, we show grace because God is gracious towards us. Judas couldn't make it up, and he knew that, but God also never asked him to make it up. And he doesn't ask us to make up for our sin. He asks us to plead the blood of Jesus over our sin. So we close Judas' story. We move on with Jesus' story. In verse 11, it tells us, meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, are you the king of the Jews? You have said so, Jesus replied. And when he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, don't you hear the testimony they are bringing against you? But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. Now, why was Pilate so amazed that Jesus gave no answer? Well, likely because Pilate had sat over many criminal proceedings before. He had watched people accused, and he had watched how they defended themselves. You know, we watch people turn, you know, vicious when an accusation comes their way. You know, when they feel like they're backed into a corner, people come out swinging. People are really, really quick to defend themselves. And here Jesus doesn't defend himself at all. That's at least what we see here in Matthew's version of it. In John's version of it, in John 18, we see a little bit more of the conversation, but all Jesus does in that conversation is he asks Pilate one question, which was basically, are you interested in this, or did other people just kind of tell you about this? Like, that's really all that he asks. He confirms that his kingdom is not of this world, and also tells Pilate, my servants aren't going to fight for me. Like, the only thing that he confirms for Pilate is we are not a threat of violence, me and my followers. That's all that he does. He doesn't defend himself. He doesn't make this big case. He doesn't point out all the hypocrisy that he saw around him. He does none of that because he is fully submitted to the will of the Father. He's confident that he's where he's supposed to be. He is confident moving forward, and he doesn't need to rile up any kind of defense. This level of submission that Jesus has is inspiring, and it causes Pilate to behave a little bit differently. In verse 15, it tells us this. Now, it was the governor's custom at the festival to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time, they had a well-known prisoner whose name was Jesus Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, which one do you want me to release to you, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who is called the Messiah? For he knew that it was out of self-interest that they handed Jesus over to him. And while Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message, don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him. Now, let's pause in the story for a second and acknowledge this might be the craziest law I've ever heard of. You know, just like once a year, we're going to let one guy go for funsies. You know, like, wake up, it's prisoner release day. Like, let's see who we get to vote for. You know, there's this crazy law that they would do as a way of trying to garner back some of the goodwill of the people that they were ruling over. And it tells us that Barabbas is the one that Pilate picks to be the opposite of Jesus in this, you know, weird American idol of who's the better prisoner or something like that. Barabbas was known as an insurrectionist and a murderer. So he was trying to overthrow Rome. He was trying to be violent. And it meant that he was a physical threat to both Roman leadership and the people of Israel. You know, he's just tipping everything over. He's just freaking out every way that he possibly can. Mark 15 describes him as a man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising. It almost seems like Pilate is trying to stack the deck of which prisoner is going to get released. You know, I've pulled out the worst prisoner that I can find, and yeah, there's this guy Jesus that you have some mild disagreements with. You know, which one should I release to you? This is his version of trying to get things to go the way that he's hoping for. It's like when you suggest your spouse's least favorite dinner as where you want to go so that you can pick the place that you get to go afterwards. Like, you know, he's trying to stack things to go his way. He's doing this in part because of the interaction that he had with Jesus beforehand, but also he's doing it in part because of his wife's warning, you know, in a dream, which was something that they really held on to as a way that, even if you weren't a believer at that time, they really held on to the idea that dreams were a way that the spiritual world would guide you, you know, whatever your faith sort of was at that time. So it's not like how we think of dreams as, you know, silly night movies in our heads. So him hearing, my wife is scared because of a dream, okay, I got to take this seriously. So he's trying to move things in a different direction. However, verse 20, but the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. Which of the two do you want me to release to you? Asked the governor. Barabbas, they answered. And what shall I do then with Jesus, who is called the Messiah? Pilate asked. And they all answered, crucify him. Well, why? What crime has he committed? Asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, crucify him. Now, that phrase that gets used here that talks about that Jesus was handed over out of self-interest, the way that that Greek word normally gets translated through the Bible is envy. And even other versions outside of the NIV do translate it as envy. You know, envy of Jesus turns into violence towards him. They want to overthrow him and rid themselves of him completely. This is all coming from the Sanhedrin wanting their position and their power and their prestige. Jesus is a threat to the normal order. Jesus is a threat to me being on top. we need to get rid of him. And before we get judgmental of the people in that moment, we also need to recognize that our sin isn't just bad things that we do, it is us rejecting God's rule and reign. When we sin, we look at God's order for things and we say, you know, that's nice, but I'll be in charge of this part of my life. That's a good suggestion, but I want to be the one that rules. I want to rid myself of your leadership. There's a great author with an even greater name named Cornelius Plantinga. He says about it, sin is disruption of created harmony and then resistance to divine restoration of that harmony. Above all, sin disrupts and resists the vital human relationship to God. What do we do when we sin? We also choose Barabbas. We're choosing somebody else. Don't give us Jesus back. Give us our own envy. Give us our own position. Give us our own power. Our real sin is choosing things other than Jesus. But as the passage goes on, verse 24 says, when Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. I am innocent of this man's blood, he said. It is your responsibility. And all the people answered, his blood is on us and on our children. Now, I understand what Pilate is doing. He was trying to kind of subtly hint at this. I don't want to go forward with this. He asked the question multiple times. He did not want to be the one spearheading the crucifixion of Jesus. And when he fully washes his hands of it, we get what I think is one of the most incredible double meanings in the Bible. Because we have this moment where all the people respond, his blood is on us and on our children. And what they mean then is they are accepting the responsibility for the crucifixion of Jesus. They're saying, yes, we are part of it. We consent to it. We are in favor of this. And we, through our sinfulness, agree with that sentiment. We get behind it too. I forget which hymn it is, but there's the famous hymn that says, ashamed I hear my mocking voice call out among the scoffers. You know, we do that through our sinfulness. We reject the leadership of Jesus, and all genuine faith begins with recognizing I am also responsible for the blood of Jesus. I needed him to die for me, not just for the people around me. However, what I love about this phrasing is that for us today, we can say his blood is on us and on our children as the claim to our freedom. That is what sets us free, that his blood is on us. There's a lot of imagery through this passage that reflects Passover. But the main one is that in the original Passover, it was the blood of the innocent lamb would be put on the doorpost of a house to show faith in God so that the angel of death would pass over them and they would be set free. This is in part why John says in John chapter 1, John saw Jesus coming toward him and said, look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. His blood being on us is our path to freedom. His death in our place is our path to freedom. In the crucifixion story, we most closely relate to Barabbas. Because the cross they hung Jesus on, in all likelihood, was gathered for Barabbas. That was who they were getting it ready for. If anyone knows what it means to have Jesus die in your place, it's Barabbas. And that is who we most closely are in the crucifixion story. He takes on the death that we deserve and gives us the life that we could have never dreamed of. This is what we get in Jesus. His blood is on us and on our children. And so, when we face our sinfulness today, when we try to live the Christian life today, it doesn't come from a place of how can I be a little bit more wise, a little bit more willpower driven, a little bit more goal focused, a little bit more able to fix myself. At every turn in the Christian life, the right answer is his blood be on us and on our children. How am I going to overcome this sin? His blood be on me. That will give me the strength. That will give me the power. That will wash away the sin. When I fall because I'm not strong enough to face it on my own, his blood be on me. What will be my claim before God the Father when I see him face to face? His blood is on me. His blood is on me and on my children. That is my path to freedom, because Jesus was willing to go where we deserve to go. We can live with him forever free. Now, the passage continues to lead us right up to the crucifixion. It tells us in verse 26, then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. Then they twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand. Then they knelt down in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. They spit on him, and they took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. And after they mocked him, they took off the robe and put his clothes on him, and then they led him away to crucify him. That's where we'll break for today. But whenever we dive into the horrors of the crucifixion, I'm always struck by one quote that a cross became a public symbol only after the last person who ever saw one died. You know, no one who saw what a crucifixion was like ever thought, cool jewelry. Like, only long afterwards did we then begin to use it as a public symbol. But all of the horror of the story just shows the humiliation, the depth to which Jesus was willing to go to cover your sin. See, it's one thing when we look at this story and we say, this is how Jesus deals with the sin of the world. But if you were the only sinner that needed saving, Jesus would have needed to die the same way, and he also would have gladly done it. If you were the only sinner that needs saving, he gladly would have gone for you. And he would have endured all of the same humility or humiliation and pain and everything so that you could be saved. So where I close for today is that as we move towards the crucifixion in this passage, we have to remember the message of the gospel is not about us being good. It's about Jesus dying in our place so that we can live. This is what it all comes down to. We are nothing if we don't hang on to the crucifixion and the resurrection. And so I would encourage you, if you've never believed today, if you've never put your trust in Jesus, don't leave without doing that. You can talk to any of us after the fact. We'll have prayer teams on each of the sides of the stage. We don't want you to leave with the idea that you've kind of morally leveled up from coming to church today, and now you can face another week and you come back for another dose next week. That's not the message of the gospel. The message of the gospel is you deserve a spiritual separation from God, but his blood can be on you so that you can be near to him. And also, for those of us who believe, let's not face sin like Judas. Let's not think it's on us to make it up to God, to think that we need to earn our way back or take on some of the pain so that Jesus will then be okay with us. He doesn't ask us for that. He asks us to claim what the crowd said, his blood be on us and on our children.